account the dignity of other people and the fact that there are other people who have certain rights.
Peace in the Middle East basically will come when the clergy in the mosque on Friday preach it, and when the rabbis in the synagogue on Saturday preach it. During the time of Camp David, one, you had political leadership that was able to contain that type of religious fervor. What the country needs is some prescient understanding of what is going to happen in the future. Welcome to another Leon China Report. What are we going to talk about tonight? The summit meeting that's going to be held in Camp David, former place that I was a little bit of an occupant with Jimmy Carter. Those of you who know me from the show know that I was fairly involved with the Camp David 1, we'll call it. And tonight we're going to talk about Camp David 2 and to get the Palestinian side of what he thinks is going to happen. We invited the ambassador for the Palestinian mission to the United Nations, who was a nephew of the chairman, Yasser Arafat, and his name is Nasser al-Kidwa. First time on the show, and welcome.
Thank you.
Is this a big event for the Palestinians?
Of course, I think it's a big event for the whole Middle East, and let's hope that it will succeed.
Now, you just come back from Cairo, and you...
Yes, from Palestine. We have just finished the meeting of the Central Council. You probably heard about the results of the meeting.
Was that the meeting that says you'd like to declare a state by September?
That was among the decision taken by the Central Council, yes, that with the end of the one-year extension period of the transitional 5 years agreed upon between the two sides, we have to take measures to actualize, let's say, the Declaration of Independence of 1988.
Now, you people analyze Israel all the time as Israel analyzes you people.
I look at the leaders now and I see on the Israeli and Palestinian side two leaders who are heavily pressured from their left and their right simultaneously and who lack any direct personal political incentive. The status quo is okay for both of them, I think. It's not okay from the Israeli national interest, and it's certainly not in the least bit acceptable from the Palestinian national interest point of view. But the kind of extremely bold gesture that's necessary to transform the dynamic that exists is hard to see. I don't see anything like that.
That if you got a framework or, you know, an agreement to agree and then an agreement not to agree, as we had sometimes in Camp David 1, would that satisfy the Palestinians?
Well, I think that we will have some serious efforts in Camp David. We also probably have kind of a process or whole procedure. I don't think that there will be only a few days meeting followed by an agreement. Probably we will see more than that. Maybe a continuous meeting with some interruptions, maybe two or three meetings. I'm not sure as yet, but we are talking here about a process which will lead to the agreement. The most important thing is to meet the critical deadline, which is the 13th of September this year.
Well, that's very important what you said now, because when we did Camp David 1, the idea was to wrap up an agreement. And what we got was an agreement in principles in September,
yes.
And then we did the treaty in March.
That's correct.
And you're saying to me that what this might be is a process and then stop and then go into a process again.
Work there. One thing that we learn about summits are not an objective in and of themselves. Summits must fit a particular objective. They have to have a certain concrete utility. And summits can be one of two things. They can be used to launch and frame the issues, to widen the space for the negotiators to explore the issues. Or summits can be decision summits, where the negotiators have negotiated, the technical people have negotiated, we have identified the small areas of difference between the two sides, and now it's time to clinch the deal. Camp David 1 was more of the latter type. They went in knowing that they had to reach a decision. Right now, I think the issues are not mature enough. They're not ripe enough. The sides still need to work at a lower level, not at the leaders' level, but at the negotiators' levels. They need to sit down and work out some of the details. This is the first time that the two sides under the current leaderships have actually sat. So you need to do some explorations. If you have a summit too early, it will fail. This is a time to do some exploratory points and start thinking very seriously about what is the time to employ and to deploy a presidential summit. So it is a tool in our toolbox. It's a tool in the president's toolbox, but as of yet, it is premature. I think if we do it right now, we'll have a failure, and a failure comes with a price. So this I will wait a little bit on.
If we succeed in reaching a framework agreement, followed by a referendum, and then an agreement itself, final agreement.
A referendum for the Israelis, and how about the Palestinians? Do you need a referendum also?
We have our constitutional institutions. We have the PNC, we have the Central Council, we have, of course, the Legislative Council also of the Palestinian Authority. And that, for us, I think, will be enough.
So you don't think you have to go directly to the people? You go through the process that's called for in your constitution?
I think so. That would be enough. But in any case, after the agreement, after the establishment of the state, of course, there should be some new elections for both the parliament and the presidents.
When I went to Camp David, we did the Camp David agreement, there was basically an outline in President Carter's mind about where he was going to go with this thing. He had done some real good polling, and he had some real good information, and I personally was involved bringing him some concepts which we worked on before Camp David. This thing seems to have happened so quickly that I'm not sure President Clinton knows where he wants to drive this. So, do you have a feeling about this?
Of course, I don't have information, but I doubt that the president doesn't have a fair idea about the direction. Let's not forget that the administration has been engaged in this thing for the last 7 years. And if the administration, after 7 years, does not have initial idea about...
No, I think they have ideas, but I don't know if they can solve the real big issues. As I understand it, Jerusalem is a big issue. Refugees is a big issue.
Indeed.
Indeed, those are the two big issues, right? Is there a third big issue?
Well, probably all the issues are big. The one which becomes the biggest is the one which is being negotiated at that point. But I think all of them are big. The territorial dimension is important.
But Nasser, do you really expect that the refugees who left Israel in 48 can go back and live physically in Israel, or are you looking for compensation there?
On all issues, I think we have two aspects. One is the principles involved, international law involved, on which the parties have to agree. The parties have to accept the provisions of international law. Another aspect is the practicalities of the matter.
Right.
What kind of mechanism we can agree upon to implement kind of a solution. I think if we apply those two aspects to all issues, including the refugee, we can find a reasonable solution.
A peace agreement would provide a lot of things to the Palestinian refugees. It would provide them with a compensation. It would provide them with a state that they could go to when it becomes a matter of life and death not to be in a state in Lebanon, in Syria, and elsewhere. It would provide them with a country to represent them internationally on the world stage. It would provide them with a country to issue them passports, of which they could be citizens, whether they live there or not. And it would provide them with an acknowledgement, I think, of their suffering. I think that one of the things that has to happen here is an Israeli acknowledgement of some degree of responsibility for what happened to the Palestinian refugees. And I think that's pretty clear. So I have a package of benefits that Palestinian refugees could get out of a peace agreement with Israel that falls short of the idea of return. but is a lot better than the really existing alternative, which is nothing, which is what they've had since 1948. So essentially, the refugees and their allies can choose between what's practically achievable, which is something along the lines of what I just laid out, and nothing, which is really what they can alternatively get. I do not think the state of Israel can be convinced or coerced to open its borders to the millions of Palestinian refugees registered with the UN. I think that's just not possible.
How about the big issue of Jerusalem?
Well, same thing. International law is clear when it comes to Jerusalem. Israeli occupation of eastern part of the city is not acceptable. Also, international community agrees that the city must remain united, must not be closed before anyone. Freedom of access to all, not only inhabitants, but to all people of the world should be guaranteed. And on the basis of this, I think we can find a solution which would respond to the rights of the two communities, the two peoples, and also the rights of the three religions of the world, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Jerusalem does not accept exclusive ownership, and I think the Israeli side understands that. Now, as an opening position, one could say it's not subject to negotiations, but in fact, if Jerusalem as the capital of Israel is to be recognized by the international community, if this is to be accepted by the Palestinians, the Arabs, and the Muslims, all Israeli officials know that a reasonable solution should be found, one which respond to the rights of the Palestinian people and the rights of the Muslim as well as the Christian.
So you're saying that it's a possibility that one thing, you could accept Israel, Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, provided that the three religions have access to the city?
No. This is I was talking about principles, but we can accept Jerusalem as the capital of Israel if East Jerusalem is accepted as the capital of Palestine.
I see.
There is no Palestinian leadership that is going to sign a deal that does not involve having a Palestinian capital in East Jerusalem. There are many ways of doing that. That doesn't mean redividing the city. That doesn't mean checkpoints and barbed wire. It just means that the Palestinian seat of government is in East Jerusalem. And it means that the Israeli position that Jerusalem is the eternal undivided capital of the Jewish people, period, full stop, end of sentence, end of paragraph, end of document, that's not workable. Jerusalem is central to the two peoples and three faiths, and there's got to be a mechanism for expressing that and sharing that. And it can't be just the Israelis saying, like, trust us. They really do control ingress and egress to the holy places as well. And it's certainly not true that Palestinians are absolutely barred from going to Jerusalem at all. But it's also true that they need permission every time they want to go. And last Easter, very few permissions were given to Palestinian Christians in the West Bank to go to East Jerusalem for Easter, for example. Forget about young Muslim men trying to get into the Al-Aqsa Mosque, for example, on certain holy days. And the Israelis can say, well, there are security concerns attached to that. All the more reason to have some kind of an agreement. And by the way, on Jerusalem, I think it's a sui generis place. It just does not, it's not like anything else. It's unique. And for a unique place, you need a unique agreement. And I think that the Holy Basin, just that little area, I'm not talking about, you know, all of metropolitan Jerusalem or municipal Jerusalem, forgive me, as Israel defines it, which is quite a big city, is what's at stake here. What we're talking about is the old city and a little bit beyond, the holy basin with the holy places. And that's what, there I think you need to have joint sovereignty or sovereignty of God or international sovereignty or no sovereignty or something. And there are ways of doing this without compromising security. There are ways of making it so that everyone feels included and that nobody feels that somehow they have been usurped. And if you want to go to dignity, that's where dignity really becomes absolutely irreducible, is in these holy places, where I think it's There's an old saying, Jerusalem is not a place to live, it's a place to conquer. You know, it's a place to have. And this has been true throughout the centuries, and certainly true since the Roman Empire. And I think the only way to take that off the table is to make it so that nobody really has it, you know, at least exclusively. Because otherwise, it's going to remain a place to conquer. And we've got to take that off the table.
The issue remains, of course, the Arab neighborhoods in Jerusalem itself. Let's try to recall certain facts. One, the overwhelming majority of Israelis have never set foot in the Arab neighborhoods of East Jerusalem. That the Arab neighborhood of East Jerusalem, including, by the way, the old city, remains overwhelmingly Arabs, in spite of all settlement activities and things of that sort. Three, that the city is actually, if not formally divided, is distinguishable. You walk in Jerusalem, the moment you cross from West Jerusalem to East Jerusalem, you immediately notice the new situation you are seeing or you are facing. So the differences is there. The actual distinction is there. What we need to do is to formally recognize the existing differences and the distinction which is there, and to try to find the best legal and political formulas to accommodate both sides.
The negotiators, have they been working on these problems incessantly, just continuously? The Israeli and the Palestinians have been meeting all the time, right?
Negotiators have been working on these issues. Intellectuals have been working on these issues. There have been scores of meetings and seminars among the two sides at all levels to discuss these issues. And it seems to me that the parameters of a solution are known.
So you're pretty hopeful.
To the officials. I am hopeful as long as the two sides are willing to take the necessary decisions. What is needed now is political decision, not ingenuity. Ingenuity, of course, will be also needed, but the main thing is decisions, political decisions on the part of both leaders. I think from our side, the Palestinian side, the will to take those decisions are there.
At the end of the day, when it comes to the borders, I think we have to look at a situation where both the Israeli leader and the Palestinian leader who signs a peace deal will have a compelling victory speech to his or her public. The Israeli leader needs to be able to stand up to his or her public and say, I uprooted a minimal number of Israeli citizens, of settlers. For the Palestinian leader, he or she will have to stand up to their public and say that I got the equivalent of 1967 borders. I got what Sadat got. I got what Hussein got. I got the equivalent of 1967 borders. How do you do that? Actually, this is one case where a circle can be squared. And we figured it out. Most of the settlers live on areas adjacent to the 1967 borders, around 2%, give or take, depends how you calculate it. Around 80% of the settlers live around 80%, around, yeah, 80% of the settlers live around 2%, in around 2% of the West Bank, which is almost adjacent to the 1967 borders. Israel annexes these settlements. Instead of this land that the Israel annexes, it gives the Palestinians an equal amount of land from within Israel. So the Israeli leader can say that I did not displace 80% of the settlers. And the Palestinian leader says, I got the equivalent of 100% of the territory that was lost in 1967. So this is really the formula. At the end of the day, whether it is on Jerusalem, on borders, on refugees, any of the issues, there is what you believe is right, your position in international law, your position in your own sense of history. This is what we call a maximalist opening position. You will never get that in negotiations. The very concept of negotiation is that you compromise. And therefore, The question is, how do you ensure that you get that something that is sufficient and do not let the perfect be the enemy of the good? Because often when you stick to your opening position, I will only accept 67, I will never accept the division of Jerusalem, you actually end up with neither. You do not get your position, and you only get the current reality that can only get worse.
The Palestinian people believe that all Palestine is theirs, just as many Israelis believe that all mandated Palestine, this territory, Eretz Israel, whatever you want to call it, is theirs. The Palestinian side now accept the compromise of establishing their own state on a mere 23% of the size of the whole territory. That's less than a quarter of mandated Palestine. So as such, the Palestinian people believe that they have already made their share of the necessary compromise. Nevertheless, I'm not saying that that will be it. We will be also ready to show some flexibility, but certainly a very limited one, given the fact, as I was trying to explain, that we have done our share, we believe.
Also, when you teach children in your schools about 1948 or 1947, when there was a partition of Palestine, what happened?
Until now we don't have our own curriculum. In the schools until now follow the Jordanian and the Egyptian curriculum. We are still in the process of establishing a new one for all the schools in both West Bank and Gaza. But I think regardless of such changes or such development, we will have to explain to them some objective facts. Until late 40s, the Palestinian population were the majority. They owned most of the land in mandated Palestine. And then things developed in a different way. The General Assembly partitioned Palestine.
Right.
Then the Arab-Israeli war started. And the whole conflict, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict entered into a new stage, I would say. We, at this stage of history, we cannot ignore our rights and our history. But at the same time, I think we have to be decisive, as the other side has to be, in accepting the historic compromise we are getting into.
Well, if you look back in history, and you can't always do that, don't you think the Arab people, you didn't have a Palestinian Authority then in 48, but don't you think it was a mistake not to accept the partition? Look at all the wars you would have saved to everybody.
Well, in retrospect, everything, of course, is easy. In retrospect, one could say, of course, it was a mistake, because had we accepted the partition resolution, the agony and the suffering of the Palestinian people would have been reduced. And we would have had a state. I'm not sure, by the way, that of the Israeli version of the story, that Israel indeed accepted the partition plan. Israel, of course, or the Israeli officials, the Israeli leaders were smart enough, were sophisticated enough to declare acceptance of the resolution. However, actually, on the ground, they immediately started to take different positions. I mean, different measures.
I don't know. I wasn't there in 48, and I can't testify, and neither can you, because maybe you were there in 48. But I believe that the world opinion would have been such that they would have held back the Israelis if they would have found. I mean, here they were, 600,000 people. There were a bunch of Arab countries surrounding them. So I don't think they were that brave to go forward. It might have been a necessity, but I'm not going to argue history now. But it would seem to me that the world opinion would have pushed them back. So I'm not sure they were that sophisticated then. Anyway, we got to cut for a break, and we'll come back with Nasser al-Kidwa, who's the ambassador of the Palestinian mission to the United Nations and is well related to the chairman, who is his uncle. We'll be right back.
We want you to be okay. And roll, we say. for every budget, so don't accept defeat.
Now you can get covered in steel.
Buy me treats.
You take care of your pets. Now it's their turn to take care of you. Visit GetCoveredAmerica.org to learn about your health insurance options.
Thanks for calling the GED Pep Talk Center. Jerry Stiller speaking. Your level 7 in your face pep talk.
I can keep pushing. Believe me, I'm good at it. But at some point, you're going to need to start pushing yourself.
See, once you've got your GED diploma, you'll feel so good about yourself.
You tell them.
You can't change your past, but you can definitely change your future.
That makes me so happy, I'm ready to bust out a dance.
Mr. Trejo, can I transfer this guy to you? My gentle technique isn't really working. You need something a little more...
persuasive?
Yes!
You listen, and you listen good.
Hey, where's my sandwich? Terry? Terry!
Take it from me to King DMC. It's a real cool thing to get your GED.
Get that diploma!
Now hold on and we'll find you free GED classes. Capiche?
Whatever motivation you need, we've got a pep talk for you. Get your GED pep talk and find free classes at yourged.org.
I wish I was in school.
If only I had a math test today.
I'll stay after class.
I'll clean the chalkboard.
I wish I was in school.
School ends, but free lunches for your kids don't have to. Find your local food bank at feedingamerica.org/summermeals for help.
It's one of the many ways to fight osteoarthritis pain. For more information on managing pain, go to fightarthritispain.org.
When you throw away money on wasted electricity, you're throwing away everything you could have bought with it. Saving energy saves you money. Learn more at energysavers.gov.
Kitchen surfaces, utensils, and hands with soapy water. 1 in 6 Americans will get sick from food poisoning this year. Keep your family safer. Check your steps at foodsafety.gov.
We're back. We're speaking with Ambassador Nasser al-Kidwa, who is the ambassador from the Palestinian mission, or of the Palestinian mission to the United Nations, and also is the nephew of Chairman Arafat. And been here for a while, and he's here on that. It's a historic moment. I mean, there's a possibility that there may be a real peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Now, both sides have a lot of work to do, and both sides have to convince their population that it is in their best interest. And most importantly, what Nasser is saying is there must be strong give and take on both sides and some flexibility. And you can't always run back in history anymore because history's past. I mean, you go to the Balkans, you won't find anything that was there before. Or you go to Yugoslavia, you'll find Romania there. I mean, things just change all the time. So it's possible that something very strong and beneficial will come out for the world and will relieve the dynamite that's implanted in that region so it doesn't blow up. You know, many times I met with... the Chancellor of Austria, Mr. Kreisky,
yes,
who gave you guys recognition way back. And yeah, I said absolutely. To him, why are you so interested in the Middle East? Why? I had long conversations with Kreisky, who was a Jewish fella. Mm. And he said, you know, if the Middle East blows up, then Russia will make an attack on me and I'll also have problems, so it's better to get peace done. So if it's possible, it'd be great. The people that I talk to, the American Jews and the Israelis, and I've just come back from Israel, I'm not sure they're clear on what they're willing to accept and they're not willing. I'm not talking about the politicians now. I'm talking about the people in the street. Mm-hmm. And you said something very interesting to me about the constellation of the power in Palestine or the Palestinian entity. And you said we were never educated together, we never lived together, therefore we have a lot of factions. And in a sense, you're similar to Israel, because Israel has a lot of factions also. And you got to be a miracle worker to bring all these things together. So in a sense, to do a Camp David with Egypt was a little bit easier because you had a sovereign government with a sovereign government. You're just talking about how to define this. That wasn't that easy, but it was in principle maybe a little bit easier because this is, you're going to start, if you want, a state. Has Barak said officially that he would recognize a Palestinian state?
I don't think that he said it in that clear term, but I also think that it's a given now that there will be a Palestinian state. I think the Israeli side understands that this might be even beneficial to them. To have an agreement between two states is something different than having an agreement between a state and an authority, for instance. So to achieve all the benefits of final agreement, I think the agreement has to be concluded between two states.
So you think it works good for both sides?
Absolutely. Of course, it's much more important for us. I mean, this is the cornerstone of our national struggle for years now, to achieve a Palestinian state for the Palestinian people, not only for those who live there now, but for other Palestinians around the world as well.
By the way, is there any chemistry between the chairman and Barak? How do they get along?
I'm not sure, but from I hear in from different sources, different places, I don't think that there's great chemistry until now. It was different, I guess, between President Arafat and Prime Minister Rabin.
Was there a real strong chemistry there? Yeah, I know he went to the Shiva.
There was some fight, of course. There was some tension, but I think that there was some chemistry as well. With Mr. Barak, I don't think that such chemistry exists now, but Maybe we need this kind of tough, strong men who would then take.
I'm going to make you feel good
decisions.
Now. I'm going to make you feel very good. When I went to visit your uncle in Tunis about 10, 12 years ago, sent by the Israeli government, I reported back to Yitzhak Rabin. And I said, Yitzhak, I think that Mr. Arafat, I think he wants to meet with you and to try and make something happen in a secret way. And he said to me, I don't believe in this guy at all. I just don't believe in him. I think he was a terrorist. I think he was, he doesn't lead anybody. Shimon Peres was more open to it. Azam Weitzman more open to it. And Chaim Bar-Lev. But the guy who was most against it was Yitzhak Rabin. And then 10 years later, I'm on a White House lawn. He's shaking his hand. And then later, he's shaking his hand more. And it winds up that he, the Arafat visits Mrs. Rabin at a Shiva call in Tel Aviv, Harav Ashi Street. It's unreal. I mean, to see all this history, you can get a little nuts, you know. But that's life in the fast lane or even in the slow lane. So the chances are that they might develop, and Camp David has a lot of magic, you know.
I hope so,
and,
yes.
The
say
food is good.
It's a beautiful place.
It's a beautiful place, a lot of magic, yeah. And a little romance, you know, and good movies. And maybe there'll be some chemistry. Do you think it's important, by the way, in relationships like this to have a chemistry, or it doesn't matter?
I think it helps. But in any case, at least confidence must be there. Without confidence, I think that things might be much more difficult, of course, to deal with such complex and
what do you say to Mrs. Ashrawi, is that her name, who says...
Yes, Hanan Ashrawi.
Hanan Ashrawi, that this thing is a waste of time, or I think that's what she said anyway. It can never succeed. I don't know who she's blaming, either your uncle or the Israelis. I'm not sure, but from what I saw, she wasn't for it. So two questions. A, does she have any real power in the state or in the entity?
Let me first say that definitely she would blame the Israeli sides, because whatever internal differences some Palestinians might have when it comes to our national issues and negotiations with the Israelis, there cannot be any disagreement on the need to end occupation, for instance, or to establish a Palestinian state. Now, when it comes to Mrs. Ashrawi herself, I think she is a very smart lady. She's excellent in dealing with the media. She is very capable, and I think she has done very well in this regard. Political influence, of course, is something else.
Is she in the parliament, or
she is a member of the parliament? Yes, from Jerusalem.
How often does that parliament meet?
Continuously, like any other parliament.
Yeah.
Yes, they have, of course, a recess.
No summer vacations.
They have a recess, definitely. Yeah, soon I think they will go into recess.
One lacks a bold leader at this point to take the initiative, especially on the ground in the Middle East. I don't see who the figure is at the moment who can mimic Sadat's multiple breakthroughs. I think Sadat really used his domestic power and his authority in Egypt to do things that were clearly in the Egyptian national interest but were considered politically incorrect. In Egypt and in the Arab world. In other words, he led, right? He dragged his country and his political culture into an arrangement that it may not have been fully ready for in terms of its own domestic political culture, especially at the popular level. I'm not talking about the government. I'm talking about the general public. But he did it anyway, because he thought it was necessary. And I see leaders now across the board who are very hemmed in by political constraints and who lack incentives to change things.
Both sides actually feel that they need a deal for different reasons, for very different reasons. Given the changes in the region, given some of the domestic political trends in both the societies, I think both leaders feel, if not a sense of immediate urgency, a sense that this has to be resolved, that the window is closing. And that is key. That is important. They feel that they've tried everything else and it's been exhausted. I think that's an important thing. The regional environment is much more conducive than Camp David one. Sadat went into Camp David 1 knowing probably that he will lose the Arab League and the Arab nations in going. And that's what happened. Egypt was suspended from the Arab League. The Arab League was moved to Tunisia from Cairo. This time it's different. This time, at least for Abbas himself, he knows that the Arab world, even the most vocal rejectionists, are on board with the Arab Peace Initiative that was adopted in the Beirut summit, that basically offers Israel not only peace, if it reaches a peace deal, not only peace with the Palestinians, but peace with the 22 Arab states. There is a political depth, a regional depth, for what Abbas will be asked to do.
Now, Nasser, you were born where?
I was born in Gaza.
Really?
Yeah, I was born in Gaza. My mother was born in Jerusalem. My father was born in Gaza as well.
What did your father do?
Now he's retired. He's now over 80.
Was
he trying to enjoy
was
life
he part
in,
of was he active, or he was just
yes I think it was kind of destiny. It wasn't a matter of choice for Palestinians to be active and to participate in the political life. Of course, not all of them did that equally, but most of them one way or another were involved.
And when did you realize, how old were you when you said, well, maybe there'll be a Palestinian state one day? When did you get involved in this?
I have always been convinced that there will be a Palestinian state. I mean, you have people here, proud people with history and determination to find a place under the sun, as we say. I have never had any doubt that this is going to happen. Now, at some point, maybe we thought of a democratic state for everybody, Muslims, Christians, Jews living together.
You mean one state where everybody
was under one
flag?
Yeah, in the 60s, this was our political program, which was totally misunderstood by the other side, and it was understood as an attempt to to destroy Israel more than anything else. And then we came up with another political program with additional concession, I might say, that is the political program of establishing a Palestinian state alongside Israel, which we are trying to do now.
Are you having any trade with Israel now?
We have lots of trade, but very imbalanced trade. I mean, we import from Israel and we barely export anything. Until now, we have to recognize that the whole Palestinian market is taken hostage, I would say, into the hands of the Israeli economy. We are, of course, in favor of economic relationship between Israel and Palestine, but I think that this economic relationship should be built on the usual fair, internationally accepted norms between the two sides.
Do you have a banking system in?
Yes, sure.
Do you have a central banker too?
We have an authority. Yes, we have a banking authority, centralized one, which supervise and follow the
how many banks?
Daily.
How many banks you have there?
We have, I think, 12.
12 banks?
12 banks, yes.
Now, this authority would raise rates or like the Federal Reserve here?
Yes, largely like any central bank anywhere. And this authority is preparing plans for new Palestinian money.
Your currency is shekels now?
Now, we don't have any legal tender. In the market, we deal with everything, dollars, dinars, Jordanian dinars, as well as the shekel.
And the one day you want to have, obviously, you want to have your own legal tender?
The non-currency, of course. That's what I was trying to say, that this banking authority also is preparing plans for the legal tender, yes, new Palestinian currency.
And you have passports now?
We do have passports. Immediately after the agreements, the authority started to issue passports, and I do have my U.S. visa on that passport as an invitee by the United Nations, of course.
And you have the customs authority in Gaza?
We have customs authority, yes, but the international crossing points are not totally under the Palestinian control. I mean, it's under shared control between the Israeli and the Palestinian side. And frankly, the Israeli side is not making our life easier. There is still lots of difficulties and problems which make any serious development efforts extremely difficult.
If you look at the Israeli side, there's been a lot of terrorism against the Israelis, mm-hmm. and so they're trying to protect their people, obviously.
Yes, you know something. I the other day I was thinking about some U.S. positions and about some statements by the Secretary himself during or in the wake of some bombings which took place in Israel itself. I can recall that at that time the Secretary spoke about the impossibility of morally equating the bombs with bulldozers. She was referring to settlement activities. In other words, she was calling for the need of complete cessation of such terrorist activities for the bulldozers to stop. Now, the last 2 years...
I don't think that'd be a great statement with Israeli people who lost a lot of people. You can't compare a bulldozer to a terrorist. If she said that...
That's what I'm saying. She said that. She said that you cannot compare...
She's a silly woman.
You cannot equate... I don't want to get into that.
No, I mean, it's a silly statement.
She said that you cannot equate morally the bulldozers with the...
Oh, you cannot.
You cannot.
Oh, I see. All right. I strike it.
Yeah.
And she wasn't silly.
Yeah. She said that you cannot do that.
I'm
okay.
Sorry.
So
this
these things stopped for the last two years, but bulldozers did not stop.
Are you working actively with the Israelis to stop terrorism?
I think there is enough security cooperation between two sides. Yes, of course, this is not my field. I don't have concrete information, but this is my understanding.
Hey, you going out like that?
Yeah, why?
Well, What would the neighbors think?
I see you!
Come look at Mr. Feather!
Look what I have.
Mr. Bird, remember?
Bark, bark, bark!
We're just playing!
We're just playing! I'm trying to get you out of here!
Even still.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who don't need perfection. They need you.
Imagine what you'd see if every child had a book to read.
Cause every kid across the nation deserves a book to read, and we can make it happen right now.
No, I don't know what you've been told, but kids with books learn so much more.
So the mission is for us to get a book to each and every child.
Read to a child today and spark a lifetime of ambition.
Know what?
What?
Since I got adopted, I've learned a lot about these humans.
I know. I mean, check out these two. It's Flirt City over here.
Yeah, I noticed that. It looks like my human is definitely into your human.
Oh, look! I think she's getting his number.
Nice.
Your human's got some sweet moves.
Takes after his dog. Oh, look, they're doing that thing where they put their arms around each other.
She kicked up a leg. It's like in the movies.
That's awesome. Looks like we're going to be hanging out a little bit more.
The average text takes your eyes off the road for nearly 5 seconds.
Wow, these are really good.
You act surprised. Practice makes perfect.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who don't need perfection. They need you.
We're back. We're speaking with Nasser al-Kidwa. I have to pronounce it correctly. He's the ambassador from Palestine to the United Nations. And his uncle is Yasser Arafat. And he told me now he was schooled to be a dentist, so he could pull teeth if he wants. And how did you get into politics then?
After getting the U.S. permission, of course. I can pull teeth outside the United States.
Really?
Yeah.
You graduated dental school?
Yes.
Where?
Cairo.
In Yugoslavia?
Cairo.
Cairo.
Mm-hmm.
All right. A state, what does it mean?
Well, I think it means everything for
you want to have an army? You want to have an army, a defense minister, a foreign minister?
An army which is really very big and which is expensive, I don't think so. Maybe we want to have an army which is more of a symbolic one. One which could be an additional coherent element for the people as
so
a whole.
You mean just a symbolic army so people could...
We are a small country, and I don't think it's a very smart thing to have...
Big defense budget.
Big defense budget, exactly.
And a foreign ministry?
The United States would not be ready to finance that, we know.
So no, I don't think so.
We don't need it.
And how about a foreign ministry?
Of course. We will have all the trappings of a state. But on top of that, the state will mean even dignity for every single Palestinian. It will mean, of course, identity, nationhood, new beginning for the Palestinian institutions. And hopefully also a new beginning in our relationship with our neighbors, including the Israelis.
Did you hear anything about the possibility of a land swap taking land in a different region and swapping it for land in the West Bank?
Well, I think it's a must because, as I said, the principle is the withdrawal, complete withdrawal from the occupied territory in accordance with the principle of the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war. Now, if the Israeli side needs some adjustments, if they need to maintain part of this land, as I said, to try to reduce the problem created by the settlement activities in the occupied territory, probably then we will have to swap this land with other lands, maybe adjacent to the Gaza Strip or maybe the north of West Bank. Or
what's your feeling about having a border that's sort of with a fence or separation? What's your feeling about that?
We will have certainly a continuous connection between Gaza and the West Bank.
How?
In a way which would ensure continuity. A road is a possibility. A bridge is another possibility. Maybe a combination of everything, road, bridge, and underground. It depends on the technical feasibility of building such a road with minimal interference with the Israeli land. But we will also have an exception of this fence-like border, which is Jerusalem, of course. If we are to maintain the unity of the city and the openness of the city, not only for the two sides, but also for other peoples from all over the world, then some additional measures might be needed in this regard.
In order for a Palestinian to travel between Gaza and the West Bank, he needs to pass through Israeli territories all the time, which could be intrusive and could be, you know, problems with terrorism, et cetera, et cetera. So they have to find a combination which allows the Gaza people to connect with the West Bank people, Palestinians, without being obstreperous to the Israeli population.
And I think that is an extremely important element, by the way.
Yeah, it's important for both sides.
Yeah.
And even if you had autonomy, you would still need such a thing. It wouldn't matter. I mean, you have to connect.
If you have anything, yeah. Contiguity of the land is a must if we are to have.
But then you have Jerusalem over here. So how are you going to connect? You would have to go through Israeli territory to get through even East Jerusalem.
No, of course. West Bank, the only problem is the connection between Gaza and the West Bank. But the moment you are in the West Bank, then you can automatically, I mean, in a very normal way, connect to Jerusalem, of course, yes.
So that's the way you think the state will look. You hope that you'll have Jerusalem and then the West Bank and then Gaza, bridge over to Gaza or something else to connect it.
A connection between Gaza and the West Bank. When it comes to Jerusalem, we hope to have the eastern part as the capital of our state, while the western part is the capital of Israel. Special arrangements would be needed for the religious sites, including those holy to the Jewish people and those holy to the Muslims and Christians, and some additional arrangements to ensure freedom of access to all believers in the walls will be also needed. The city will have to remain open and will have to remain undivided. We don't disagree with that. This is a position which is strongly advocated by the Israeli side, and we accept it. But
so you accept, we went through this once before, but it's very important. You would accept Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, providing you had East Jerusalem and access to religious holy sites, etc., etc.
Our religious holy site is part of East Jerusalem, physically and historically. It is part of East Jerusalem.
How are you relating now to the king and Jordan?
Well, we have, I think, a very positive relationship between the Palestinian and Jordanian side. We think that King Abdullah is doing a good job, and we think that we can rely on his support, and we can work together for the better future of the two peoples, the Palestinian and the Jordanian peoples.
Yes, there will be negotiations again. I have no doubt about it, because there is no other way. Fiats don't work. Diktats don't work. The Palestinians aren't in a position to dictate anything to the Israelis. The Israelis have tried imposing their will unilaterally in southern Lebanon, and it didn't work. They didn't like the outcome. They tried doing it in Gaza and the northern West Bank unilaterally. They didn't like the outcome. The lesson is not, I mean, there are some Israelis who are opposed to compromise who say, look, we withdrew from southern Lebanon and we got rockets across the border. We withdrew from Gaza and we got rockets across the border. So you land for peace is meaningless. These Arabs are incorrigible. That's completely the wrong lesson. The right lesson is that when you make an agreement, as with the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty and as with the Israeli-Jordanian treaty and even the armistice between Israel and Syria, when there's an agreement that both sides find beneficial, they will both work to maintain it.
And so, frankly, we have two models right now. We have a model of those Palestinians who, post-independence, want, you know, just to become dependent on oil charity, like some Arab countries are today. This is the way that many of them, this is the only way that they know. They will be moving in that direction. There is more space for corruption and making your own money under this. But there are Palestinians. You know, Salam Fayyad is the most obvious face. But you go to Palestine and you talk to young in their 40s, in their 50s even, the business community who understands that to make real money, to have a real economy, you have to integrate in the global system. And the way to do that is you integrate yourself into Israel, Europe, a gateway towards that. Jordan, by the way, will be a key component as Jordan tries to kind of reformulate its economic policy to become more competitive. I can see this hub, Jordan, the Palestinian state, Israel, becoming actually a regional hub that's a link with between the Arab world and the West.
10 seconds, a year from now, where will things be?
Well, I think a year from now we will have two embassies, a Palestinian one in Israel and an Israeli one in Palestine. And
two ambassadors.
Two ambassadors.
Keep the people working.
Thank you.